The conference committee for Senate File 2725, the restructuring of the gang and drug task forces, will come to order. Let's start with doing a round of introductions, because I think most of the members from the Senate are not necessarily judiciary or public safety members, and so might not be familiar with one another. So why don't we start here with Ms. Pontius.
I'm Kathy Pontius. I'm Senate Counsel for Judiciary. I do the civil law and data practices issues.
Ken Backus, Senate Counsel for Judiciary. I do the criminal justice issues.
Chris Turner, fiscal analyst for the Senate.
I'm Scott Dibble, state senator, represent District 60, which is southwest and part of downtown Minneapolis.
I'm Patricia Torres-Ray, represent District 62 in the Minnesota Senate, which is southeast Minneapolis.
Senator Chaudhry and Senator Coring are on their way.
I'm Mary Liz Holbert, state rep for most of Lakeville.
Bobby Champion, state rep for the southern part of North Minneapolis, North Loop, and half of downtown Minneapolis.
Deborah Hillstrom, state representative from all of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park.
John Lesh, state rep, St. Paul. I got Rice Street, Payne, and Arcade.
Becky Perius, House Research.
Michael Pamar, state representative, the western part of St. Paul.
And I'm Senator Moore, and I represent the east side of St. Paul. Representative Pamar and I have had a chance to talk about how to proceed. We all know that time is of the essence. There's not too many days left. It is our intention to try to wrap this bill up today. So for those of you who have parts or pieces in this bill, this morning is your only shot at persuading either of us to consider the provisions that are in the bill. I think that what we would like to do is to do a walkthrough of the language where there are provisions that are different. We would like to talk about them in as expeditious manner as possible. And if individuals want to comment on that, the chairs would deeply appreciate you commenting at that time. But we would also ask you to take into consideration that we don't have much time. I think both the House and the Senate go into session at noon, and we'll make a determination if we're going to go a little bit later or maybe recess and coming back. But I hope that in the next 40, 50 minutes, we are able to walk through the bill. And then we'll spend the rest of the day today. We'll just have to make a decision on how we're going to reconvene and get back together. So why don't we go off of the – Mr. Chair, do you have any other comments?
No, I think that's fine.
Why don't we have counsel walk us through – I think there's a side-by-side summary for you to look at, and then there are side-by-side language. And because – I mean, people should feel free to use whichever document – but the bill is not that long. I guess I would prefer that we do the actual bill language, if that's and go off the actual bill language. So, Ms. Pontius or Ms. Perius, which of you would like to take us through? Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair and members, I'll start with a couple of Senate-only provisions that are on R1. The first one, Section 1, is an amendment to the law enforcement data statute that adds a special classification for gang criteria, and these would be based on the criteria that are developed by the Violent Crime Oversight Council. And it classifies gang criteria as private data on individuals. However, if you'll note, like on 1.9 to 1.21, if there's an active criminal investigation going on, it would be confidential data. And then there's also a data sharing provision in here. The main effect of this section is that under the general law, once an investigation becomes inactive, the data are public. And this would say that if it was an inactive investigative data, but it involved gang criteria on an individual, it would remain private. So it's accessible to the subject, but not to the general public.
Mr. Chair, members to the House members, this is an amendment that was put on the floor. This language was brought to us, I believe, by I believe this amendment was put on by Senator Clark, but it was written by law enforcement and brought to us by law enforcement. Does anybody here want to speak on this issue? Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, and members of the conference committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. These are a number of sections, like Section 1, that are related. They relate to each other. Section 1 deals with a part of Section 7, so it's gang criteria. Now, whether or not you decide to go with this, there are some policy issues why you should not. But at least I want to point out some things that are at least some general policy issues you might want to discuss. First of all, this is complex, and I don't know what the relationship to other entities are and the law. Secondly, we've had a general provision that when things are made public after inactive, it's very important for the public to know certain things. Generally, things that are not public are victims of child abuse, you know, certain things like this. To say the criteria of why an individual was suspected or where an investigation was done, why that person was a gang person, why the public should not know, I don't understand. So I think there's a right to know for the public on the gang criteria. Second, when you talk about the development of the gang criteria, you've got to remember, if you go to your operational language on here, and some of the new language, you're asking the new oversight council to come up with a new thing of gang criteria. So is this going to be the gang criteria for local gang databases that places like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and other entities have? That's not clear. Is that gang criteria going to be separate than what the gang criteria that will be developed for the gang pointer file? So those are some kinds of things you've got to work through. The other thing is, if you look at subdivision 24, it's a broad an item that says where basically any this information can be shared with any law enforcement entity if it's pertinent to the furthering of an investigation. And I got some concerns about that. And the final point on this is, I don't know, and it has been sometimes issues in different statutes, what the definition of law enforcement agency varies from statute to statute. And I have not had time to take a look at what law enforcement agency means in this point. So, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are my upfront things on this, but I think you'll see it as you go down through the legislation, how it relates to other components of it.
Anybody else want to be heard on this section? Discussions, members? Representative Hailstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask a question about once the data becomes public. So once the data is public, anyone would be able to go in and get the data that was collected about anybody. Is that correct?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Representative Hailstrom, yes.
So, Madam Chair, imagine conflicting gangs going to the information to collect data about who's in other conflicting gangs. Is that something that could happen under this?
Well, Representative Hailstrom, under the current law, without a definitive classification right now, we are in that gray area.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, right now it is being provided to anyone who asks, or it is not being provided to anyone who asks based on policy rather than based on law, if we're in gray?
Representative Hailstrom, our understanding is that, and anybody here in the room, correct me if I'm misstating this, that the law statute is not clear. Law enforcement has been able to, particularly the GangNet type databases, have been able to, under a presumption of active investigative information, although I don't know how that holds up to the test if the information is being kept for 10 years, that the information that we have is that no one has asked for it, according to Sheriff Fletcher. If people asked for it, they would give them the information. But since no one has asked for it, it's not that they don't give out the information to tell people that they're in this database. That being said, there has really not been a test, I don't think, or a challenge to whether or not the veil of this being an active investigation database would really meet the challenge that it's an active investigative database that would then make it confidential. And so I think that as a matter of policy, it's a gray area, and it's not yet been challenged. Representative Champion?
Just for some clarification, the testifier talked about a gang criteria. And is there currently a gang criteria that is not articulated in this side-by-side? And if not, is it truthful that the development of this criteria will be done by this oversight committee? And will it apply to just local folks? Or the local folks are able to do their own? Or is this criteria that they come up with something that is going to be followed by all the gang task forces?
Ms. Pontius, could you clarify for us what the reference to 299A.641 is talking about?
Madam Chair and members, there are gang criteria under current law. If you go to R4, you can see the current law language and how the bill proposes to amend it. And on the Senate side, it appears on 4.28 to 4.36. And on the House side, it appears on 2.34 to 3.6. So you can see the current law there, which both the House and Senate bills would modify.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Kamar? This is the pointer system criteria.
Ms. Pontius?
Not gang net, is that correct, or am I wrong?
Chair members, I think this is not necessarily limited to the pointer system. The pointer system uses these criteria, but there's some other places in the law that cross-reference it as well. So it's not in the pointer system statute. It's mm-hmm. in the Oversight Council statute.
So members, within the other part of the bill, there's explicit direction in both Senate and House language for the Oversight Council to review and update whatever these criteria is. And if they choose to stick within the 10-point pointer-file criteria, then, that's up to the Oversight Council to make that determination.
And then, Madam Chair?
Representative Champion?
And then would modification by the Oversight Committee be a directive to the others to follow the same criteria, or would the locals be able to continue using their own separate criteria that they have outlined?
I'm not sure, Representative Champion. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, I think that's kind of an open question. There are some places in the bill in current law that specifically refer to these criteria for different purposes. Like if you look at the language that's in the Senate on R1 on 1.15 and 1.16, it specifically cross-references that this is what the gang criteria are.
Representative
Pamela? But I don't know if there's anything in the law that there's kind of a gray area in terms of, well, what if they're using some other factors that maybe aren't those criteria? They're not completely tied together. So.
Right. And Madam Chair, I think this was, two things. One is that what we're trying to get here, at least on page R4, is that the commissioner would have to sign off on the new criteria, objective criteria that were identified to, that the department would have to sign off on that. But I don't believe that except for those entities that are getting state funding under this statute, that they would have to comply with these requirements. So in other words, in the Ramsey County situation, Sheriff Fletcher would not be obligated to comply with this because he's not getting state funding under current law. That's my reading of it. I think Mr. Neumeister's sort of chomping at the bit down there, but.
Mr. Neumeister?
Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, you are correct, Representative Paymar. It is not clear. One of the things that some local entities, and if you take a look at the draft policy that I have of the city of Minneapolis, of how they collect data, that they use a low threshold standard of reasonable suspicion under federal guidelines that have been referred in this discussion, 28 CFR 23, which has some low type reasonable suspicion standards. And also, he also talks about, and Ms. Levy Pounds may be able to address in general, one of that 10 criteria. But you are correct. You could have different entities. And that was the crux of the issue that you may have missed on the House side, because on the Senate side, there was more discussion. The issue is, do you want to have the same criteria for gang pointer file as you do with these local gang databases? And that's the policy decision. There was a question just that Senator Moore brought up about what is investigative data. And I just wanted to share this with you. If you take a look at 1382 subdivision 7, investigative data is collected or created by a law enforcement agency in order to prepare a case against a person, whether known or unknown, for the commission of a crime or offense. So it's very specific to an individual who you think is going to commit a crime. The other stuff that is the big elephant in the room is the term intelligence data, criminal intelligence data. So what's happening here is many entities are trying to put what is criminal intelligence data into the investigative data section, and that's where the conflicts are. Now, if you're going to ask in St. Paul, in Ramsey County, and GangNet, and other entities that are trying to put it in the investigative data definition, where it's not preparing a case, so it's just that Rich Neumeister was associating with somebody, I would say that's intelligence data, and I would say could contend would be a violation of data practices. That's the big elephant in the room. How do you put the round holes in the square rather than round holes and squares for squares?
Any other questions or discussions on this section? Anybody else, the authors of this, the language, want to come to the table to talk about it? Or I guess maybe they don't. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with the accountability or the sunshine factor in this section. And as I read it, I don't view that anything ever becomes public and that it becomes destroyed after 5 years if there's no new inputs on that particular individual. And I'm not sure what happens relative to information on residences, et cetera. It's kind of silent on that, those data elements. And so my concern is while you have some reporting around the issue of the juvenile notifications and the numbers, et cetera, where is the sunshine relative to the operation of these kinds of databases? And then for just a big general question that I'm still unclear of, is it, and I apologize, I'm not on judiciary and human data practices stuff, but is the Senate moving towards trying to have all of this in one database with a set of rules and the operability and accountability, or are they comfortable with a bunch of different entities having their own different games? Concerns about the accountability and whether or not you're going to move towards a central one or everybody's going to have a different one.
Well, Representative Hulberg, the Senate has been trying to get to the point where you're at, which is that there should be uniformity. There should be one set of guidelines. What's good for the state databases should be good for the local databases. Transparent. The public should have an opportunity to be given a rationale for why they're in certain databases. There should be an audit process in place to ensure that. And according to the audit process, you know, if people don't meet those criteria, then the data should be purged. And I think what this piece is trying to get to is that if somehow you're in this database because of some factors, and maybe after 5 years you're purged because it doesn't come to be anything, should there be some adverse consequences to you, some collateral consequences for having been in here? Touching on Representative Hillstrom's point was that, you know, how do we protect people who may have gotten put into the database? Under current practices, for the local databases, is a pretty loose standard on how somebody get into that database. And so isn't it the sunshine piece of it? You know, how do we balance fairly the individuals who get inputted into these databases at such low standards? How do we protect them from having that information being used and misused in the way that results in adverse consequences to them? But how do we at the same time balance law enforcement's ability to have information for their purposes? I mean, there are all these things that are being, you know, have come to the conversation. We've been having those conversations in the Senate because we felt that it was important to have those conversations. In all honesty, I think that we've not had much help from law enforcement in having that conversation. I think law enforcement has taken the position that they want unfettered ability to put people into these databases. And any attempt to try to impose some oversight, to impose some sunshine, and to perhaps address some of the potential collateral consequences on people who get put into these databases is somehow abridging or hindering law enforcement's ability to do their law enforcement work. And I think that there's just so part of the difficulty in this has been that I don't think that we've had a good partner on the part of law enforcement to be having these conversations. And unfortunately, I think the public and the community is going to be disadvantaged by that inability.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, this is where I'm confused, and maybe research can help me out here, because it seems that we're talking about who gets in these databases and where the information is public and where it's not. And that, of course, is not the historical way that law enforcement kept track of individuals they thought were problems. There's a large spectrum between collection of data in a database at the high end, and we decide who has access to it and whatnot. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where the cops on the street know who the problem people are, and they talk to each other about it and either keep an eye on them or don't, depending on how things go. And somewhere between there are varying levels of what kinds of information get to what points, and then who has access to them at that point. We're talking, it seems to me, at the highest level of that where this information gets compiled, which, of course, is advantageous for law enforcement because then it enables sharing, which is what they want to be able to do in order to be more effective in their law enforcement. At the low end, where the cops are just talking to each other on the street, it doesn't most effectively enable sharing, which thereby restricts the ability to address gang problems that cross jurisdictional boundaries. But Representative Paymer already brought up the point about, you know, we're just not necessarily applying to people or agencies that don't take state funding on this as well. So let's say that we even got ahead of this and said, well, at some point we're going to apply this to agencies that aren't getting state funding, so they have to follow these rules as well. What is stopping, and maybe someone in research can tell me this, what is stopping a local agency in that eventuality that they have to comply with everything here from just coming up with their own system so that it's not public, so that they don't have to disclose, or that they can make up the rules on their own about what they want to do with respect to disclosure or what gets included? What would stop them from crafting a system that just avoids the technicalities that this statute sets forth as requirements for them?
Well, Representative Lesh, that's the world we live in today. So you're right that maybe putting this in place is just not going to, may not help. I don't know. Okay. Representative Paymar?
Sure. I'm just sort of looking at the time here. And, we have just still on the first two sections here. And I kind of like us to at least get through the bill. This is the sticking point. And, Madam Chair, I don't know what your experience has been, but I have to say that my experience, at least trying to work on this issue, has been a little bit different. And I have not found, at least the law enforcement agencies that we work with on the House side, to not be open to looking at setting up some guidelines. In fact, I think if you ask Mr. O'Malley, Superintendent O'Malley, he'd say he thinks that's a good idea. It's just how we do it, how we get there. So I don't know if we can resolve that in this conference committee, but I do think that there's willingness on their part to come up with some statewide criteria for this.
Great.
Mr. O'Malley, is that true? Can you just say yes or no? I don't want to put you on the spot speaking for all of law enforcement, but that's at least the meetings that we seem to have had on the House side. I thought we were getting close to something.
My name is
Superintendent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of the BCA. The answer is yes, Representative Paymar. And I'd make one, and I'm speaking on behalf of, I guess, the BCA or public safety. One other comment on the language that was first being addressed here in subdivision 30 on R1, that was language that was suggested by law enforcement. And the goal, and I know there's, it's led to a much broader discussion here, but coming back to just that narrow language, that was intended for the reasons that Senator Moy just articulated, I think, very clearly, that there have been concerns that there have been unintended consequences of some of this classification of a person. And this was intended to be a step in the direction of saying, if it's an ongoing criminal investigation, it needs to remain confidential. Everybody seemed to agree to that. But if it's not, and it's public data, it was a gray area. How do you define crime? But if it's clearly not part of a criminal investigation, to make it private and then provide some safety to those persons who are listed there but they're not part of a criminal investigation, so they could challenge it because it's private, and they wouldn't face the consequences of maybe being mischaracterized as a gang member when there isn't sufficient criteria to have been met. That was this narrower goal of this language here, was to use data classifications to provide that protection so that persons wouldn't face consequences that they shouldn't have to face. And I think I can speak. There's people here from the chiefs and sheriffs that on my second comment about this language, law enforcement understands that concern. And this was our attempt to try and address that so that persons wouldn't be labeled as a gang member publicly. And it could affect employment. It could affect jobs, housing, all those kinds of things. Say, no, the fact that you had one picture and met one of the criteria, that doesn't meet it. And I don't care whether it's a local database or the state database, that's private. Until you get to the level of an active criminal investigation, then it's confidential.
Professor Levy-Pounds? And then I'm going to come back to Senator Torres Ray.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nakima Levy-Pounds. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. And many of you have not been present during the extensive hearings that happened on the Senate side. So I just want to take a moment and help to frame this discussion regarding the research that our office conducted. We released a report in December of 2009 called Evaluation of Gang Databases in Minnesota. And that was at the behest of community members who were concerned about the Metro Gang Strike Force's role in collecting gang data on individuals, as well as the lack of oversight and accountability and protocols regarding collection of data. And so we started the process by holding community meetings to gather concerns of people who were seemingly affected by these databases. Our law students spent hundreds of hours researching different statutes, looking at law review articles, making contact with people from various law enforcement agencies and other officials within the criminal justice system in order to put this report together. And what we found was very troubling. We looked at two databases in particular. We looked at the Gang Pornophile System, which is a state-run system, as well as the Ramsey County's GangNet. Now, we know that in 1997, the legislature authorized the creation of the Gang Pornophile, and there are specific standards in place governing how the gang pornophile system operates. The gang pornophile system had 2,438 individuals listed in that system when we got involved. And again, there's at least some language in there regarding audits, purges. A person has to be at least 14 years of age, have been convicted of a gross misdemeanor or a felony, and meet three of the 10-point criteria that have been referenced here today in order to be entered in the gang pornophile system. Now, in 1998, through a grant from the Department of Public Safety, Ramsey County established the GangNet system. When we started looking at GangNet, we found that there were nearly 17,000 individuals who were listed in GangNet as potential gang members. And what we saw from GangNet was a lack of criteria for entry. So, for example, in the gang pornophile system, I laid out you have to be at least 14, gross misdemeanor, felony, meet three of the 10-point criteria. Well, to end up in GangNet, all you need is to meet one of the 10-point criteria. And when we looked at the 10-point criteria, we saw that they were subjective and overly broad, and it's very easy for any person, especially one living in an inner-city community, to meet one of the 10-point criteria, even if you're not actually involved in gang-related activity. And so that in and of itself raised a number of concerns. The other thing that we heard from individuals was that officers would round up youth in the community, African-American youth, and take their photographs. And, you know, they would end up in these systems. So we have to understand what is happening regarding the big picture, as well as the role of the Metro Gang Strike Force in entering this data. I think that that's one aspect of this that has not been highlighted throughout this particular conversation. In our research, we found that in the Metro Gang Strike Force's 2008 report, they state that they made the documenting of gangs one of their top priorities. And in fact, in that year alone, there was a 13% increase in the rate of their documenting of supposed gang members, which meant that 1,000 extra people were added to the system in that year. And we know what has happened since 2008 regarding the level of corruption that has occurred with the Metro Gang Strike Force. And one of the things that we called for in our report was, at the very least, a special audit of GangNet. From my understanding, it has never been audited. When we met with Sheriff Fletcher to discuss this issue, and we talked about the fact that, contrary to the gang pornophile system, where data would be kept for 3 years and then purged if, you know, the person did not commit another crime, data could remain in GangNet for 10 years. So at the time that we got involved, people's data had been stored for at least 10 years. And if they were to meet an additional one of the criteria, then they would actually be in GangNet for another 10 years. But once we started talking to Sheriff Fletcher, he ended up reducing the number from 10 years to 5. So he used his discretion to do that. But one issue is that this does not just affect Ramsey County or its residents. GangNet is used by 96 agencies across the state. The other consequences that happen if your data is entered in GangNet is that an enhanced sentencing standard could be applied if you are, on trial for committing some type of crime. And that's a 10-year enhancement to your sentence. And so prosecutors can use the data that is in GangNet to help build a case to show that someone was probably a gang member. Now, courts may not solely rely on that particular information, but they can bring in an expert who could be a law enforcement officer working in a gang unit to say, yep, this person has a tattoo. Yep, they're in a photograph. Yep, they hang around gang members. So they, you know, and that could be evidence that's presented before a court. And again, that could add 10 years to a person's sentence. So we're talking about some very serious issues here regarding accountability and oversight. And the fact that audits are not occurring, even though state money was given to help establish a system like GangNet, is very troubling. So I don't know if there are any questions, but I wanted to help frame this because I know some people were out of the loop as far as these issues are concerned.
Professor, why don't you just stay there for a minute? We have a couple of questions. I don't know if they're directly to you or to others. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wish Senator Mimoa would be here, but Mr. Chairman, I think that it is problematic for us to try to really go over hearings and testimonies that these two committees, both in the House and the Senate, went through and bring testifiers to tell us something that they already told you and you, Senator Mua. So I have heard a lot about this. My constituents, I have several emails, you know, with different positions about, you know, supporting the House language, the Senate. I just don't think that we should replicate the work of judiciary. I am more interested in trying to figure out if these two groups, the House and the Senate, right here, could go over this language and section by section find out which section we could approve today, because we have 20 minutes, and it seems like we're going to hear testimony that you hear for over a period of how many months. And I don't think we have the time. We have 20 minutes to do this. So, Madam Chair and Representative Paymer, I would like to request that we go section by section and try to figure out, you know, if the House is not in agreement with the Senate version, what can we do to come up with an agreement rather than hearing testimony as to why people think that the Senate version is, because we're going to redo the work that judiciary did, and I don't think we have time to do that.
Senator Torres-Rae, I think that's... I would also like to do that, and Madam Chair, I really think that's the database pieces that are really outstanding here and need more work. Okay. And whether we can do that today, I don't know. There's two options. We can try to hammer it out, or we can create a working group and, you know, define what that working group does and who's going to sit on it and get this resolved. I believe that can happen. But I do think the majority of the bill, our differences are not that great, and I would like to go through the side-by-sides and get those resolved and then come back to this if we have time would be my preference. Oh, Representative Lesch.
Can I, just because the professor's here, I do have some questions if we could ask that while she's here, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I have a follow-up. Madam Chair, I have a follow-up question, if I may.
Your chair.
to your point, Senator Torres-Rae, and then we'll come back to Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, I would like to follow up on what Representative Paymer is suggesting. If we have an issue that is the issue of contention and difference, could we put it aside, adopt the language that we could agree on so that we can come back? Because if we stay here, we're going to use all of your time, all of our time, just on the issue that we disagree on. So could we move the language that we agree on, put it aside, and then figure out what are the pieces that we, I think Representative Paymer has an excellent suggestion, just agree on the things that we could agree, and then it seems like the database is the issue, and maybe if you want to
Senator Torres-Rae, mm-hmm. That is my intention.
Okay.
But we can't have a discussion. We might not be able to come back today. And so the reason why I'm taking this approach is so that we put all the information on the table. And it might be that then if we can't come back because we're in the House and the Senate, we can at least have enough information to be making offers and counteroffers in an informed manner without having, because I don't know that we'll have another opportunity to all come back here and have people give us their thoughts on their sections of these bills that are important to them. That's why I thought it would be important to do this. And so if you all feel that you've heard enough on this data provision, that's fine. We can move on to the other sections.
Madam Chair?
Representative Lesch had a question first.
Thank you. And I appreciate your indulgence, Madam Chair. I did hear at the first couple of hearings, but for the last few hearings I was in the Army last year, so I didn't get to hear some of the follow-up hearings. But Professor Levy Pounds, based on what you said, I did want to ask you the question that I asked here of research, and I don't think I got an answer on that. Maybe you can help me out. But first, with respect to the items of evidence that went into that gang net, have you found any of it to be where there are allegations that there are items of evidence that are false? And maybe you would answer, well, there hasn't been an audit, so we don't know. But are there individual examples that, you know, you can cite that are absolutely outright false? And then second question is, can you foresee, not that you have an example readily available, but a model whereby even if we restrict law enforcement's use of criteria for whether at GangNet or Point of File or whatever, a scenario whereby we could restrict them from just crafting an alternative method that suits their purposes that maybe is not shareable across jurisdictional boundaries, but nonetheless, which they can thereby use. And I would add also that I suspect it would still be submissible as evidence in court as well, as long as it's accurate information and applies to the rule of evidence. So those are my two questions for you.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. In terms of your first question regarding whether there was any false data in GangNet, in December, I believe, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, could have been January, conducted an audit of the gang porn file system. And in their audit, there were about 14 pieces of data or 14 files that ended up being deleted or purged from their system because of missing information, inaccurate data, and, you know, missing documentation, et cetera. From my understanding, all of those files originated through the GangNet system, because what we have to understand is that GangNet has been a feeder system for the gang pornophile. So if there is a taint within GangNet and it has not been audited, then that does impact the accuracy of data in the gang pornophile. And so of the data that was purged from gang pornophile, from my understanding, it originated from what had come through the GangNet system, as opposed to from other agencies. Additionally, in our work in the community, we encountered at least two individuals who, one of whom had been involved in a gang in his youth and wanted to join the National Guard and found out that he could not get a permit to carry because of data that was held through the GangNet system. And so he filed an appeal, and Sheriff Fletcher opposed it, basically saying that, you know, based on that evidence from the past, that, you know, he shouldn't be allowed to get his license to carry. So he's been effectively prohibited from pursuing a career in the National Guard. There was also another young man whose father testified at the community hearing that you attended, named James Sheldon, who talked about how his son had been misidentified as a gang member. And he's a student at Metro State, and he wanted to pursue a career as a probation officer. But again, because of that confidential data, they said that confidential data was being held on him. He believes that it was because he was mistakenly input into a gang database system, even though he is not a gang member, according to what he and his father are stating. In terms of her other question about local law enforcement agencies, this was never about restricting law enforcement's ability to collect data. But this is about ensuring that there's accountability, that there's oversight, that there's some protocols in place, and it's not a free-for-all in terms of people's ability to collect data and use it in a way that could detrimentally impact another person. So I could envision a situation where local law enforcement agencies come up with some clear-cut policies and protocols that would balance the need for public safety versus the rights to citizens' privacy. So I think that that's possible, but it definitely is going to take time, and whoever's involved will have to be very deliberate and intentional about ensuring that the mistakes that were made in the past are not continuing to happen. And in fact, many local law enforcement agencies already operate their own database systems. They've just been outside the scope of what's been discussed here in the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and back to this section one where I started a while ago, and I understand you're not wanting to regurgitate everything, but the fact that this was a floor amendment and data issues actually matter, and Senator Mao, I don't disagree with anything that you said about the importance of this issue, but it's very complicated, and the language in section one lacks any sunshine. And I don't know how you get about that accountability factor. There are fairly good protections for the individuals with the purging and the private classification on data on individuals. But I still am skeptical that it actually gets to where we need to go, where we have the accountability factor that is so necessary when you provide broad latitude to collect this type of information about individuals.
Well, we have till the end of the day. Maybe the House, you know, will think about this information. Let's see. Section 2 of the bill is the it's a provision that was brought to the Senate. I think it's a separate bill that has been I don't know if it was introduced in the House and went through the process or not. But Section 2 of the side-by-side language is the this is called the traveling data language. Representative Paymard, this is a department, this is an agency bill, I believe. Came to us from whether it's the BCA or the the department. Does anybody want to come and maybe talk briefly about this so that the members of the House know something? If not, we don't have to. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Conference Committee, this is a, from my point of view, a major issue. Over on the Senate side, there are approximately five people who testified who had major concerns about this provision. They were as follows: myself, Donald Gemberling, representing COGI, the Teresa Nelson, the ACLU.
Can you, Mr. Neumeister, what is the what does that acronym stand for?
It's the Minnesota Information and Government.
That's all right.
MinCOGI, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information.
All right.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the Conference Committee, there were a number of items brought to the attention. Some of those issues, as the bill now rests, have not been addressed. And those are as follows. Again, I look upon this as the big, broad perspective of criminal intelligence. I didn't bring my props up here, but I could easily have showed you criminal justice national system, suspicious activity reports being shared from states to states. And one of the kinds of things that I have concerns about this specific language is as follows. What is being proposed is 49 other states, whatever they may decide is an investigative data, whatever, will dictate how we're going to treat that here in this state. I'll give you an example. There, as you know, we have done due diligence work here at our state legislature that you, the legislature, determine the classification of the data, not other states. So if you look at the proposed language, a state can determine, say, oh, we're willing to share this with you, but we have a broad exemption that says, oh, this cannot be released to the public because it could be an invasion of privacy, you know, some of the broad things. And so who is going to make sure whatever the other state says is correct? Secondly, if it doesn't fit the category of an investigative report or it's, you know, someone you're preparing a case for, how do you determine it? What is it going to be? It should be public, but a lot of things somehow, because we don't have a definition of intelligence data and sharing, like suspicious activity reports, which can be very innocuous, or other kinds of things like that, I think that needs to be addressed. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, also is, again, the issue of the public accountability. So are we going to have a state, another state, determine what the classification is? Now, if any of you are interested, I listened to the testimony on the Senate side of all five or six people that testified about this section. I can give you the point on it if you're interested to testify. But for me, this is needs a little bit more work in the bigger issue of intelligence gathering, Mr. Chairman or Madam Chair and members of the Conference Committee.
Very good. Anybody else want to be heard in this section? Okay. Ms. Pontius or Ms. Pirius? Section 3?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair. Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real briefly, the benefit here is that when information is part of a criminal investigation in another state and is provided to Minnesota, and we do not have a criminal investigation going in Minnesota, right now, that information would be public in Minnesota. That could be extraordinarily detrimental to criminal activity in other states. And it will, what it will result in, the harm to Minnesotans is that other states and they have told me this. They will not share that information with us anymore. So if something's going on in Hudson, Wisconsin, and they want to tell Stillwater about it, Stillwater doesn't have an investigation, the public can now know about Hudson's ongoing criminal investigation, and everybody will be tipped off to it. The word equivalent in subdivision 2 means that data in Wisconsin or in North Dakota, it should be treated, if they have a criminal investigation, treated to equivalent to what it would be in Minnesota. They can't, if they want to classify every time they walk up to somebody and say, hi, what's your name, a criminal investigation, that doesn't mean it'll be protected here in Minnesota in that way. What we do, what we would do is if Hudson gives us active criminal investigative data for Stillwater to be aware of, we've had a series of daytime burglaries during funerals in Hudson, Wisconsin. You might want to be aware of this and watch for that happening over there because they could just as easily drive over the bridge. And they might even identify some people. But we're not investigating in Minnesota. Now we can protect that information. If that's the type of an investigative data in Wisconsin that would be criminal investigative data in Minnesota, then it will be protected here. I think it's as simple as that, and it's, again, I think it would be in this age of sharing information, which can be a very good thing across all the states, this can help protect Minnesotans. And the last thing I would mention is that, as with the last one, is everything here perfect? No, but we're trying to really come up with some practical steps dealing with current law and current classifications that we can move in the right direction and not have the real bad event happen so that we can try and move incrementally. And I would agree, I think the working group would add to that in the long run.
Mr. Johnson, do you want to speak or just here to answer questions?
Madam Chair, I could certainly answer questions. I think the key in understanding this section is to understand that the data we're talking about has to be evaluated and meet the definition listed in line 2.1 through 2.3. So when you receive that data, you have to apply that definition in order to move forward in the statute to know how to handle it. And so so when you get something from another state, you have to look at it, and it's got to fit the definition of investigative data. If it does, then it guides you in how to treat it, which means then it will enjoy the same classification in Minnesota or equivalent classification that it had in its originating state, purpose of which is to ensure that other states will keep us in the loop on information that may be important to Minnesotans.
Any other questions, Representative Holbert?
If I might take this to the next step, it comes in as investigative data. So you then, and it's coming from a state in which it's, confidential, and we get it, we use it, there's no crime ever committed, it turns out to have really no investigative purpose or value any longer. Then, if ever, at what point does an individual have the ability to review that information on themselves?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, once it transcends to 1382 Subdivision 7, investigative data in Minnesota, it follows the same path as any other data would in Minnesota. When the case becomes inactive, statute of limitations expires, it goes through court, it then reverts back to public data.
And Madam Chair, can you tell me where in your statute it addresses how it changes classification and loses that protection as traveling data?
Ms. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Holbrook, if you go to line 2.12, when investigative data classified under paragraph A become part of an active investigation in this state involving an adult, the data are classified as provided in section 1382. Once it enjoys the 1382 overall classification, it follows all the provisions of 1382, which includes subdivision 7 requirements.
Okay, and so if I might, then just to back up, then what you're saying is that you are going to classify every piece of data coming from outside the state as investigative data coming in.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that when you apply the standards of data practices, you have to follow the guidance provided by the statute. So when you got a piece of data that came in from another state, you would have to evaluate it to see if it met what the legislature defined as investigative data. You would have to make a good faith attempt to say that this is, in fact, meets that definition. If it meets that definition, then all the rest follows. If it does not meet that definition, it does not enjoy any of the other protections.
Well, Representative Holberg?
Madam Chair,
you're saying that when it comes in, it keeps the classification of the state it's coming from. So if it, the state says this is confidential information under our umbrella, and you never use it for investigative purposes, so you don't fall into the scheme of when the investigation is done, it becomes private on the individual, so that that data doesn't enjoy that transformation, if you will, as becoming investigative data and eventually being found by the individual. How does that classification ever change from being confidential coming from other, the other state into our state?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, what I'm saying is that it is not assumed that all pieces of data that someone lists from another state as investigative data automatic or any information they give automatically enjoys the same classification in their state as in the home state. What I'm saying is when you get the data, you have to apply the definition that's included here. If it fits the definition of investigative data, then and only then does it, the rest of it follow through. If it does not fit it, then it becomes public data. It does not get the class, even though it may be classified differently in the home state, it is not classified the same way in Minnesota unless it meets the definition of investigative data.
Okay, and so then if I might, why would any other state give you the information that they have deemed as confidential or whatever their private terminology is for their particular state, knowing that if it's not useful to you in an active investigation, it's going to become public? And they lose their protection, in other words.
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, the situation we face right now is there is no protection whatsoever. As soon as it hits the state of Minnesota, it's all public data, which is inhibiting the transmission of the data. But what I'm saying
is... No, I get all that.
But I'm trying to work around what you're saying, and I'm sorry, I'm a little tongue-tied in trying to get us there. So I apologize for that. What I'm saying is that it's the obligation, when we send data to other states, we have to have a general idea of how their data practices laws work in those states, so we have a reasonable level of confidence of how it's going to be handled and whether it fits our public policy, our desires, and anything that we might be doing. The idea is that other states will have the same responsibility to understand what the lay of the land is in Minnesota, and understanding the Minnesota law will then take over and rule the day on how that data are handled, Representative. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but you still haven't answered my question.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
It's the transverse of what you're saying on the investigative data. It's data that never becomes part of an investigation. So, in other words, you get information about an event involving 10 people. 8 of them are bad actors. You're going to investigate them. You may come to some kind of accounting for their behavior. They may cross the line. 2 of them were just innocent bystanders. So that portion of that information around that those innocent individuals is not going to be part of the investigation. You've weeded them out. They're not bad actors. So you've got data on the 2 innocent bystanders that comes here as confidential from another state. It doesn't hit the pipeline of investigative data to follow along with eventually becoming private on an individual so you can find out about it. What happens for the information on the innocent bystanders? Does it always remain confidential in the state of Minnesota, or at what point does the innocent bystander know that, holy moly, Florida just sent this information about me that's not correct, that's floating around in Minnesota databases somewhere, is impeding my ability to get a job or a rental contract, whatever, and how do I as the individual ever even know that it exists?
Ms. Pontius, can you take a stab at Representative Holberg's
Chair,
question?
Representative Holberg, it would be treated however it's treated under Wisconsin law, say. So whatever Wisconsin does, Minnesota will comply with. So at the time a request for access is made, if that same data in Wisconsin are confidential, it'll be confidential.
Right, so innocent bystanders will never know. That's why they can't get a job anywhere, or they can't get into school, or they can't be a probation officer, because now we have protected information.
Ms. Pontius.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it could, if it changed in Wisconsin, let's say it became an active investigative there.
Eventually,
there,
then
and,
they could
and
figure
data
it out.
There are public, then it would be public in Minnesota. If it never becomes public in Wisconsin, it would never become public in Minnesota.
Any other questions, on the, Superintendent?
Very briefly, Madam Chair and Representative Holbert, I think Ms. Pontius just hit right on it, that person would still be protected here. If the case I gave before, if Hudson has 10 people over there and they end up prosecuting them, or they end up completing their investigation, the prosecutor says, we won't prosecute them. That idea that it's now, it would be public in Minnesota, that classification, right? Because it can't be prosecuted, statutes run, or they've been prosecuted and convicted. Then that information that came over, when the request comes in, Minnesota has to look at it at that moment. And while it had been confidential, we'd then say, okay, their case is done in Wisconsin. It's no longer confidential here in Minnesota either. It enjoys that same classification.
But, Madam Chair, I don't think that's the case if Minnesota never conducts an investigation and gets that individual's data through that pipeline so that they can eventually find out about it. I mean, I like in Minnesota that at some point an individual can find out what is in a database about them when the investigation is closed. I like that. So are you telling us that we're just supposed to buy whatever Wisconsin does forever and ever? It's going to remain at whatever Wisconsin has, no matter it was a Minnesota resident that just went over and was in a convenience store at the wrong time. And you got information on a Minnesota resident sent to us from Wisconsin that they will never, ever even know about because Wisconsin never declassifies it.
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, if Wisconsin decides they can claim it to be investigative data for eternity, even though the case has been prosecuted and they don't give it up publicly, okay, when we get that request down the road, we check with Wisconsin, say, you gave us information, they've been prosecuted, right? Yeah. That's public in Minnesota then. When we're saying, not the way they classify it, but the fact situation. They have an active criminal investigation, it's confidential here. If it becomes, they've completed it all, we apply Minnesota's standards in Chapter 13 to that information.
But, Superintendent, that's not what's being proposed. I mean, if this new language were to become law, it changes that, because what you're describing is current law.
No, Madam Chair. The idea is that current law is it's public here. If we don't have a criminal investigation, it just is. Now we look at what the situation is in the other state and apply our data classifications to it so that it meets the investigative data classification as it should be.
Any other questions on this section? Okay. Ms. Pontius and Ms. Pierce, why don't you walk us through Section 3 of the Senate, Section 1 of the House. We have a chart. Does everybody have the chart? Can we pass out? There's a chart that my staff put together to help us kind of just at one glance get to look at the next section deals with the Violent Crime Oversight Council and the composition. I think that the House and the Senate were very close in terms of the new composition. And then a couple of floor amendments on the Senate side changed that a little bit. Representative Paymar and I have talked about this, and I think the goal in putting this section of this bill together was that I think there's been input from the commissioner and others, and our collective goal was to try to make the composition of the council more manageable in terms of the numbers of people who will participate in the council. So that was sort of the overall goal. It wasn't an issue of, you know, not wanting somebody to be on the council, but it was like, how can we pull the mixture together so that the number of people who are on the council, I think under current law there are 32, and we're just trying to get to as low of a number as we could. And so... The little cheat sheet that you have gives you a summary of what is being proposed in the Senate, the House, and in statute. Ms. Pontius, or is it Ms. Pierce? Ms. Pierce.
Madam Chair, book Section 3 in the Senate, or Section 1 in the House, restructure the Gang and Drug Oversight Council And since they're very similar, I thought I'd briefly go over the similarities and then look at some of the differences in various subdivisions. The Senate is creating the Violent Crime Oversight Council, and the House is creating the Violent Crime Coordinating Council. Both are reducing the membership of the council, as the chair mentioned, as well as outlining the duties of the council, the commissioner of public safety, and the statewide commander. They're both directing DPS to certify multi-jurisdictional entities, and DPS must require an entity to be subject to the operational command and supervision of one of the participating agencies and have adequate staffing and funding to support the operations. DPS is also authorized to revoke an entity certification and order action that is deemed necessary. Both bills are directing an entity to establish a governing board, and the entities must process evidence through a standard evidence handling procedure. And finally, both are replacing the Oversight Council's report with a report from DPS to the legislature. So moving to the differences, the House is repealing the current Gang and Drug Oversight Council, and the Senate is amending current statute. And looking at Subdivision 2 on the membership, that's on R2, the House is reducing the council membership to 17 members, whereas the Senate reduces it to 24. And you can probably see the difference most clearly on page R3. The House does not have the following members that appear in the Senate version. The Senate has two additional citizen members. It has a representative from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the FBI, and legislative members from the House and Senate. Moving to Subdivision 3 on the Senate side and Subdivision 3 on the House side, this starts on the bottom of R3. This relates to the council's duties, and the difference here is that the House language does not require the council to establish multi-jurisdictional task force, and that you can actually see on page R4 on line 4.19. And the House does not develop impartial policing and prosecution policies, and that is clause 8 on the Senate side at line 4.25. The House is also removing references to guidelines in conformance with the next subdivision. Moving to the next subdivision, Subdivision 3A in the Senate and Subdivision 4 in the House. This is at the bottom of page R4. These are similar. They're setting up a certification process for task forces. The differences are the House is requiring DPS to certify the entity as well as the designated fiscal agent. The House is limiting certification requirements to entities that receive state funding and requires all entities and fiscal agents to be audited on a biennial basis. And that you can see on page R5. It's line 3.14 on the House side. And these audits may be paid for through grant funding. And that is on line 3.24 of the House side. Other differences, if revoking an entity certification, the House will limit DPS's authority to take actions for purposes related to this section, and that's on line 3.29. The House and Senate also have different deadlines for current task forces to be certified. The House has a fixed date of December 31st, 2010. That's on line 4.5 of the House side, and the Senate has 6 months from the guidelines. And that's on 5.20 of the Senate side. The House is also directing an entity to provide in its joint powers agreement that the parties are subject to the provisions in this subdivision. And that's on line 4.1 through 4.4 of the House version. Moving to Subdivision 4, the statewide coordinator. Subdivision 5 on the House side is similar. This starts on R5. But the actual difference is on R6. The House has additional language on 4.16, clause 5. It's directing the statewide coordinator to review task force audits, take corrective actions, and submit a summary report of the audits. Moving to Subdivision 5 on the Senate and Subdivision 6 in the House, also on R6. This relates to participating officers in employment status. And the House language directs an entity's operational supervisor rather than the governing board to conduct the annual officer performance reviews. And that's on 4.25. Subdivision 6 on the Senate side and Subdivision 8 relating to evidence handling are nearly identical. This is on line 6.9 of the Senate and 4.3 of the House. And the House language does not include seized cash and physical assets. Moving to Subdivision 8A on the Senate side and Subdivision 11 on the House side. This is at the bottom of R6. This pertains to the governing board. Under the House language, the prosecutor's responsibility is different, and this you can actually see on the top of R7. In the House language, the prosecutor's responsibility is limited to recommending to the governing board the nature and frequency of officer training. And over on the Senate side, starting on line 6.25, the prosecutor has a broader role to ensure adequate training for officers, advise on lawful handling of property, and ensuring compliance with forfeiture reporting. Subdivision 11 is the next difference on the Senate, and Subdivision 14 on the House. This is also on R7. And these are just language differences. Subdivision 12 on the Senate and Subdivision 15 in the House, which is still on R7. These relate to the reports. And unlike the Senate, the House does not have a report on criminal gang investigative data systems, and it instead requires a report on the summary of all task force audits that were conducted in Subdivision 4. And you can see that at the very bottom, House line 5.29 and Senate 7.19. So that concludes the major differences between in that section.
Representative Paymar, in terms of the differences in the composition, I wondered if we could just work off of the little cheat sheet that we have here and see if we could maybe just get some information about some of the differences here. I think, if we look at the composition of the Oversight Council, the major difference is that the Senate has two additional citizen members, and we have the federal participants, as well as we have the legislative members. And I wondered if the House has any particular feelings about the extra members that the Senate has in our language.
Madam Chair, I'll give you my thoughts on it, and Representative Hillstrom would like to chime in here. I personally don't have any problems expanding the council members on the Oversight Council. I think that in our discussions with the department, they were the ones who said that they didn't see the need to have DEA and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms or an FBI member on the council. That came from the department. The reason why we didn't put a senator or a representative in here, although I'm not adverse to it, is just, I guess part of it for me is it's a time commitment. I think that based on what happened with the Metro Gang Strike Force, I would hope that this council would see that their responsibilities here are much greater than perhaps some of the participants may have thought. And so if legislators are going to serve on it, I just think that the public spotlight is on this Oversight Council now, however we craft it. And we have to ensure that what happened at the Metro Gang Strike Force never happens again. And so if legislators would want to serve on it with that caveat, then I would be fine with it. But Representative Hillstrom had it.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question just was going to be, I see that the current statute has DEA, BATF, and FBI, and did they offer anything to the current situation would be the question to determine whether or not it's of value to have them in the future.
Again, Representative Hillstrom and Representative Paymar, this was a floor amendment. The my bill, as it was progressing through, didn't have, I think my bill mirrored pretty much the House composition. But the body of the Senate voted for these amendments to put these individuals here. And so I haven't had an opportunity to have discussions on whether or not, you know, where they're at. You know, interestingly, as we look at the Oversight Council and its composition, Representative Hillstrom, you were there with me throughout the summer when we were having these interim hearings on the Metro Gang Strike Force. And I don't recall, and maybe if the commissioner is here or somebody from the commissioner's office could provide some information. For the life of me, I can't remember if the Oversight Council had any public meetings or had any meetings to look into the situation regarding the Metro Gang Strike Force. And so I wondered then what kind of oversight did they provide, and did they then in that oversight capacity provide any kind of guidance or intend to provide any guidance to where we're at? Does anybody know whether or not the Oversight Council, because I'm kind of thinking that all the different players involved in this, the one voice that has been the most silent on this issue has really been the Oversight Council.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can tell you that the very month that the controversy broke, the Speaker appointed me to that council, and I did not think that if I, as the chair of the committee, was going to be investigating what was happening, it was appropriate for me to attend the meetings. I did, however, send my staff. However, I do not believe that it was ever reported back to me that there were the internal investigations. But, Madam Chair, I felt that it was very important, given that I was not part of the board discussions during what was going on, that I really separate myself while we were doing our external investigations in the House here and Senate.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, I think you just supported Representative Paymar's point about whether or not legislators should be part of this process. I mean, that was the point I was trying to make in keeping this off, but the body of the Senate thought it was prudent to do this, so.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My suggestion would be that in the event that our bodies are going to be doing oversight over this group, that we give it some thought, if you're going to put members on this, whether it should be the very people that are going to do oversight that then gets appointed to the commission when a controversy breaks, or whether they shouldn't, because I think that if you get appointed to the board after a controversy breaks and you have a different role of doing oversight, it's very, very difficult to do both of those roles at the same time, Madam Chair.
Point well taken. Any other questions on the chart? Does the House have any particular concern about expanding the four citizen members from two in the House language to four? Any particular concerns about that? Okay. Well, we'll set that aside. And Senate members, have any particular thoughts on the composition? Any questions on any other areas of differences between the House and the Senate language? Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, on page R4, line 4.25 to 4.27, I think the House doesn't have similar language or the same language. And I just want to draw the House's attention to that. It's R4, line 4.25 to 4.27. Right. Representative Lesh.
Can I just clarify what that means? And maybe this was gone over in committee, but improper use of personal characteristics such as race, color, national origin. I'm guessing that if you have a race-oriented gang, race would certainly be a pertinent and proper use of personal characteristics to identify. But can someone give me an example where that line is drawn, just so I'm clear on that?
Representative Lesh, I believe that there's a tremendous amount of discretion in determining what's proper and improper. I would assume that in the ethnically based or racially based gangs, it's, of course, it would be, it would not be improper to make that part of the character. So.
Well, I was, Madam Chair, I was just wondering, I'm sure there was some discussion out of some examples, but maybe we don't have that. And if that's the case, that's all right.
Anybody here want to comment on that section?
Madam Chair. Eric Highland, Meserly and Kramer, representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Minnesota Sheriff's Association. And maybe I'll just take this time to make my general comments on Section 3. I think, first off, there's a nuance between the language in the House bill and the Senate bill that I think is important. The language in the Senate bill kind of piggybacks on existing law that created the Metro Gang and the statewide gang task forces. With this new organization, the state's not actually creating anything. These local task forces are going to be, in many cases, already exist and are locally many times put together with joint powers agreements. And so when you tell the commissioner in terms of developing the guidelines and whatnot, it was felt from a local control issue that these are creations of local government and not creations of the state. It's important to note, however, that I think if you go to page R5, lines 4.1 to 4.4, the language in the House essentially attempts to do the same thing that the Senate language says. It simply says that when we're putting together these joint powers agreements, the organization agrees to abide by the general guidelines that the commissioner sets forth for the operation of these task forces. So that's a subtle difference, but I think it's an important one in terms of local control. Specifically, Senator Moi, with regards to 4.25 and 4.27, and I think also if you go to the language previous to that.
Which page?
I'm sorry, on the Senate side.
Which page?
R4. And there was also another section that I'm not able to find right now. But I believe the reason that language is not included in the House language is the belief that, again, at the local agency level, all of these policies and procedures already exist. So it's essentially a duplication. On the local level, all of our officers are abiding by these local procedures and these local guidelines on an agency-by-agency basis. And therefore, even when they transfer to a joint powers agreement, their behavior isn't expected to be any differently than it would be operating in their local agency.
Representative Hulbert?
Well, Madam Chair, then to that point, then what's the problem if they're subject to the state standards if they're already doing it?
Well, if there are state standards, obviously officers are already abiding by those. I think for several of these things, I don't know that there are necessarily state standards. If the post has a standard, every licensed law enforcement agent in the state has to abide by those post standards.
Well, Representative Hulbert?
Madam Chair, and I guess just that from a very big 10,000-foot level and having a conversation with some law enforcement officials in my office, I believe that when any police officer in the state took an oath of office, they did so to uphold the laws and standards of the state. I do not believe for one second that there were not officers outside of the gang strike force that knew that there were problems for a long time. And given that nobody really blew the whistle, if you will, for a period of time, I believe that those that had knowledge shirked their duty to uphold. So from my perspective, to the degree that we can set standards at a state level and make all entities adhere to them. I don't see the need for a whole handful of different gang databases. There should be one statewide gang database. That's my opinion. This is just a new chapter of a different issue with small groups going it alone and getting way off base. And, we had the gang pointer file, but now we have a different, gang net that's different. We're not following the standards. So I'm a little leery when I hear you testify that the locals got this under control and they have their own standards, because just if you compare Fletcher's database to the state database and the testimony of the professor, it's pretty clear that there are vast differences in those two entities, and we need this stuff to stop. At least that's my opinion.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I wasn't going to go down the gang database. My comments were not related to the gang database. My comments were directly specific to 4.25 to 4.27. If there are state guidelines to be developed, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board is the proper venue for those standards to be created. I agree with your statement earlier on the whole gang database issue. It is probably not an issue with regard to Section 1 in the Senate bill that we can probably resolve here in the next 72 hours. Law enforcement's committed to working within the confines of however you define and charge the working group in this bill to continue to discuss those, because I've got 24 years of history on data practices issues, and this is a tough one that probably can't get resolved in the next 3 days.
Council, are we?
Representative Kamar? I'm not sure if Mr. Hyland was saying, but it was our intent, I think, Representative Holberg, is that we wanted to tighten up state standards relative to these multi-jurisdictional entities. That was always the intent, is that we had some basic standards, and some of them may go over and above what the post board criteria is, but we always wanted to have some state standards that governed this, and if multi-jurisdictional entities chose not to seek state funding, then they weren't obligated to comply with it. But if they wanted state funding, they would have to, and that the commissioner would have to sign off on that those standards, and that would become, in essence, the certification process. So if ever a situation came up again, like what happened with the Metro Gang Strike Force, the commissioner would be able to determine that they're not meeting the standards and decertify them, and not get into a situation like we got into last summer, where DPS was essentially impotent except to cut off their funding. So that's what we were trying to do, was put some overall control and rest it with DPS.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would go farther than you. I would prohibit interjurisdictional agreements in law enforcement that don't meet the standards. I don't think you need uncertified groups running around outside of the state standards and finding creative ways to fund themselves. To avoid the standards.
Representative Holberg, I agree with you. We did not do that in this bill. And for that matter, I think that there are, I'm not sure about this, Mr. Hyland, do you know, but I think in Hennepin County, Sheriff Stanek has a unit that does not get any state funding, so probably would not be under any control of this, but based on the statute. Is that accurate, or
Representative Paymar, I'm not sure about that. I'm not familiar enough in the operation of that. But I would point out again that on page R5 on the House side, lines 4.1 to 4.4, that is the language, I think, the hook to say that if these task forces are receiving state money, they have to put in their joint powers agreements that they're going to abide by these guidelines that are developed by the commissioner. I think both sides want that to be the outcome here.
Excuse me for a second, Representative Lesch. On that note, Mr. Hyland, you would want them to abide by, but if we're going to develop a policy as in subsection 8 on R4, line 4.25 to 4.27, you're opposed to that?
Madam Chair, no. No, I didn't say that. I think the belief when we were going through this language is that our officers are already subject to these policies and procedures. No matter if they're out on the street as part of their agency or part of an interagency task force.
So you don't oppose to this language being here?
I guess I would. The only thing I would say, Madam Chair, is I believe that we think it's redundant.
Madam Chair, I don't know if he's on the same place. Are you talking about R4 Senate language on line 4.25 point 4.27?
Right.
You think that's redundant language?
I believe Representative Paymar that that language was not included on the House side was there's a portion in here, and I apologize because it's. I also believe it's on the Senate side dealing with evidence handling and forfeiture that, again, those are existing standards that apply to every single licensed sworn officer already, regardless of where they're practicing. Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, I don't think we're going to have any heartburn if the conference committee decides to put that language in.
Mr. Chair, if I could just point out that, I'm guessing this is comfort language because it is already unconstitutional to do that absent a compelling state interest. But, I understand that maybe sometimes we need to have language to save a law enforcement agency from itself because the consequence of that is that evidence is thrown out of, in fact, that's not followed. That said, I did originally want to follow up, Madam Chair, on Representative Holberg's comments about how we manage these agencies, and she doesn't want rogue agencies running around the state doing whatever they want. I think it's important to maybe point out the obvious that the job of this Congress committee and, in fact, the committees that this went through is to ensure that we walk that line, because if we set the standards too tightly, creative agencies and law enforcement agents will find ways to collect the evidence that they think they need in order to affect successful prosecutions as well. So I just wanted to make sure that committee members were aware of that's what we're dealing with here, ensuring that we walk the line, that we don't end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and we get an effective policy that manages what we want to do. But it's kind of like trying to, for example, outlaw certain kinds of narcotics. A new one comes along because someone's creative and comes up with a new one, and then we have to regulate that. And a new one comes along, and we have to regulate that. And we try to get around it by legislating against isomers and the salts of isomers or whatever kind of drugs they have. And that's the language we have in statute. But we need to ensure that we don't wrap this too tightly, whereby creative actors do come up with new ways to skirt the rules.
Any other questions? Move briefly section 4 and 5 of the bill.
Madam Chair, I am just wondering, we just broke for caucus, and I think that perhaps our members would want to be part of that. I'm just wondering how much, if we can either get done rapidly or if we want to reconvene or...
The rest of the language that we have here, there are still a couple of sections where it's either Senate only or House only in the workgroup language. So I think that we may have to come back together to finish walking through the rest of the language. Why don't we recess? And then you want to tell us when you're able to come back in?
Absolutely.
We have an idea. So, why don't we take a... I think the Senate's on the floor, so why don't we take a recess and we'll post when we get back in. Senator Dibble?
We're in a recess.
We're in recess. Well, then the Senate members will hang around, and once you've had a chance to caucus, you can let us know and we'll post Well, for members of the public, we'll put a notice on the door. Hopefully, you know, in time for all of you guys to know when to come back. And we'll also post electronically. We're in recess. Senate members, can we talk for you?